This is Barry Tyker from the UW Oral History Project. It's February 21st, 1990. I'm at Mrs. Gertrude, in the home of Mrs. Gertrude Wilson. And we're going to continue going over our list of people. And we noticed that there was a very significant omission on that list. And I think, Mrs. Wilson, you might want to begin by talking about that omission.
Professor Kiekhofer. He was a professor of economics and a very significant person in the university faculty for many, many years. The Kiekhofer Woods still exist on the west side of Madison. He lived in a house on Arlington Place. And he was one of the beloved and important people, always received a skyrocket. He had a son, Bill Kiekhofer, who became a student in the medical school and later a doctor.
Now, why are the Woods, was that part of his property?
His wife. His wife was a very wealthy woman.
And he donated the Woods to...
And they were called the Kiekhofer Woods. You go out Mineral Point Road. It's on the right, and there's a little park there now.
Westmoreland Park?
No, it's beyond Westmoreland. Okay. A little park, and it's very wooded area. Do you know the name of it?
No, I don't.
Well, anyway.
That is Kiekhofer. There was also, wasn't there a Kiekhofer wall down on campus?
Well, Gladys Kiekhofer was his...
No, there was a
wall. That was where her, I think...
Students would put graffiti.
Yes, but I think that it wasn't a Kiekhofer wall. It was where her father lived.
Oh, okay.
I think. I don't think it was ever called a Kiekhofer wall.
Okay. I thought I had heard that at one point, but...
You may
have. Our next person is Laird.
Oh, Professor Laird was a professor of classics and lived in University Heights in the house that the chancellor now lives in. He was a very lovely gentleman of the old school and was, brother was a student of his. My brother Philip was a student of Dr. He was always called Dr. Laird, never professor. It was always Dr. Laird. And I can't tell you any more than that.
You just said something that's always that's always interested me a little bit. Now, why was he Dr. Laird and why was Kiekhofer Professor Kiekhofer?
I know, it's a strange thing. Some of the professors were always called doctor, the PhD doctor, of course. And some were never referred to as anything but professor.
So it didn't necessarily have to do with whether you had a PhD
no,
or not.
No, it didn't. It just was, for instance, the ones that came here as Horace Callan from Harvard, always was called Dr. Callan, always.
And students would refer to them as either doctor or professor?
Yes, either one.
You didn't call them Joe or Sam?
Oh, no, you never talked to your...
What about the women professors who had PhDs? Were they called Mrs. or were they called Dr.?
Well, most of the women professors whom I knew and remembered were in the medical school.
Okay.
So you see that by virtue of being a doctor, they would be called a medical doctor, though those I told you about.
Okay. Yeah, it's just that you hear those different references and you wonder if there was some sort of a hierarchy that was there or...
I don't think so. It's just some were doctor and some were not. It was Dr. Prokosh.
What about Lorenz?
Oh, Dr. Lorenz. Well, Dr. Lorenz was really a forerunner of the modern psychiatry. He had a private sanitarium, which is now Oakwood Lutheran Home. Those little houses or little cabins were houses in which he housed his patients. And that was his, well, that's where he operated on. That's where he took care of people and where his office was.
Now, was he associated with the university?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, I don't know whether William Ellery ever had any contact with him, and William Ellery Leonard, mm-hmm. whether had he any had contact with him or not. But incidentally, I checked and found out from the cemetery. William Ellery Leonard is buried, but they moved, the grave was moved on the Freeman lot, it was Charlotte Freeman who was his first wife in two lives.
Hmm. So it wasn't his last wife.
Oh, no.
It was his first wife.
It was his first wife who committed suicide.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
And the Freeman lot is just beyond my own lot where my father and brother are.
Is that up in this?
In this Forest Hill Cemetery.
Hmm. What time did that sanitarium open, do you know?
No, I can't tell you when, but in 1932 to 1935, there was a woman who lived above me who bought the little house, which I think is still standing, a lovely red brick house across the road from Oakwood. I think the house is still there, but there are also offices not in the house, separate buildings, which I think house an architect's firm. And that sanitarium was in use around in the 30s, I think.
Okay. I'm not sure.
He was a very important person, Dr. Lorenz.
In what sense that he was?
In that he was a psychologist or psychiatrist, really, what we now take for granted. But it was an innovation then.
Okay. So he was really one of the pioneers.
He was a pioneer in that field.
Was the idea of sanitariums like this, was that sort of new also?
Oh, that was very new.
Now you,
the only one I ever heard of in Madison.
Before you heard of sanitariums, what would happen? Where would people go who were mentally ill?
If they were dangerous or mentally ill, they went out to what we used to call the poor farm on the way to Verona. Hmm. And I think the place still exists,
mm-hmm. Yes,
on the right hand side going west.
A big structure.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the really insane were in one part, and those who were not dangerous were in another part.
Now, how was Mr. Lorenz's place different from that?
Oh, very different. This was, I
Dr.
think,
Lorenz, excuse me.
Well, Dr. Lorenz was a private thing, and the other was a county, was supported. You see, they used to call it the poor farm. And if you had no money, that's where you went to live. And you were supported.
And that was a county agency?
I'm pretty sure it was a county.
That's interesting. Now we have someone whose name I'm not sure how to pronounce. L-E-N-H-E-R?
Leonard.
Okay.
Victor Leonard. Professor Leonard. Who lived on Summit Avenue, at the top of the hill there, where between Lathrop and Prospect, there Summit Avenue goes up the hill.
Right.
And it's on the north side of Summit Avenue, and he was professor of chemistry, and it was he who was rather cantankerous and had a very unpleasant wife. Whose dog?
Was that why he was cantankerous?
I don't know. But he and Professor Hillier didn't hit it off. Remember I told you that.
Right, right,
Professor
yeah.
Hillier left, went because to Connecticut.
Of this, because of
oh, they just weather. Didn't like each other. And Professor Hillier thought that Professor Leonard had not been fair to him. I think Professor Leonard must have been probably in more authority.
Mm-hmm.
So Professor Hillier went to raise peaches in Connecticut.
Yeah.
They had a lovely time. Much less stressful.
Great. Well, the next name on the list I think we've pretty much covered, and that's Leonard.
Oh, yes.
So we'll just we'll probably be throwing in remarks about him throughout the course of the rest of these interviews. So the one after that is Linton.
Oh, the one who went to the anthropologist.
Very famous man, Ralph Linton.
Yes, Ralph Linton. Ralph Linton married a childhood friend of mine by the name of Adeline Briggs. Adeline Briggs was the daughter of Harry Moseley, the founder of Moseley's Bookstore. She was his daughter. And Adeline Briggs had married, prior to her marriage to Ralph Linton, had married one of Professor Holfeld's sons. He had two sons, Rudy Holfeld and Carl. And she married, I think it was Carl, because Rudy was drowned in the Amazon. After what became of that marriage, I can't tell you, but in her final marriage was to Ralph Linton, the anthropologist.
How long was Linton in Madison?
I can't tell you, probably about 10 years.
Oh, that long?
No, I think he went to Yale, didn't he?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so she moved out and spent the rest
well,
of her life.
Well, she's dead.
In the East Coast.
Everybody's dead but me.
Survivor. Lighty.
Oh, we must, I'm so glad we're not going to forget Mr. Lighty. Professor Lighty was really the founder of WHA.
Hmm.
He was in the University Extension Division. He and his wife and three sons lived on the house I think is still standing, a farmhouse on the old Sauk Road, almost where it joins the old Middleton Road.
Mm-hmm.
Down the hill from the president's house, closer toward the old Middleton Road.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Lighty was a Quaker. He was a very interesting man. They kept sheep, which they sheared. They raised sheep, and he experimented with what later, of course, became radio, was radio, and really was the first person to found WHA. He had three sons, Harold, who was my age and whom I was very fond of, and he of me. Too bad we didn't get married. And Russell and Paul. Harold died. They're all dead now.
And now, what time did the WHA come about under Lighty?
Well, let's see. I knew Harold Lighty when I was about 10 or 12 years old.
Okay.
And they had, I think, an anniversary celebration a few years ago here, either the 50th or 75th or something, a big one at the university.
Let's talk about radio in Madison for just a moment now. When did your family get their first radio?
Well, that one upstairs, which you must have seen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
We got from the Madison Gas and Electric Company. In probably around 1930, We came back to Madison in 32, around 1936. And then my brother bought for my mother one of the very first FMs put out by Zenith.
When did FM come about?
Well, that was probably, see, mother died in 1961. Probably in the late 1949 or around 1950.
So when radio first started in Madison, there weren't all that many stations on the airwaves.
Oh, no. And there were some wonderful programs, though. Every Sunday afternoon was the telephone hour. We'd have the telephone hour. We'd have the Firestone hour. We'd have the New York Philharmonic every single Sunday afternoon. Wonderful music. And that's what I miss very much now, because most of what you hear is this, what do you call it, rock stuff.
When did Texaco start sponsoring the Met? That's certainly been on as long as I can remember.
Yes, I can't tell you when.
I just thought you might know. Okay, let's move on to Professor Mendenhall.
Oh, Mrs. Mendenhall.
Mrs. Mendenhall.
Mrs. Mendenhall and her husband. Her husband was professor of physics. She was Dorothy Reed Mendenhall, a graduate of Johns Hopkins Medical School. This is his wife, you see. And when they came to Madison, in the very early 1900, something around there, they lived in the house on the top of the campus, which is just where later, where Dean Comstock lived, mm-hmm. where the observatory
was. Oh, yeah, okay, that tells me.
There's a house there.
Yeah, there still is.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where they lived first. They lived there for several years, and that's where their only daughter fell off out the window and was killed. They had two sons, Tom and John. John Mendenhall has for years, but he's now retired, been chief surgeon at the VA here. Tom was, for a while, president of Smith College. Her two sons were as different as day and night. John lives with his wife, Sally, around Lake Mendota, on the north side of the lake, and still goes to the VA and does a lot of volunteer work. Mrs. Mendenhall established a free baby clinic in Madison, which was used by a great many of the faculty wives. And she was not a lovable person, but she was a very capable person, lived right up in Dr. Richard T. Ely's house. That's where they moved to. Incidentally, she was a descendant of the Indian chief Massasoit.
Oh, really?
Yes. And if one saw her in profile, there was a distinct resemblance to an Indian squaw.
Besides the free clinic, which she started for babies, did she practice medicine in Madison?
No, she didn't practice, but she did that. And the doctors in the city were furious because it took away their business.
I'm sure they were.
But she was really a great figure in Madison.
Do you have any idea when that clinic would have been operating?
Oh, yes, probably. In the early 1900s.
Was it in any way sponsored by the university?
No. She just wanted to do it herself.
Did she just open up her doors of her house?
She opened up and people came there.
That's interesting.
And incidentally, if my mother had taken me there, I might have not had the trouble with my stomach that I did. Mother didn't believe in women doctors.
Well, that's an interesting question. I suspect that your mom might not have been alone in that.
No, you see, it was unheard of to have a woman physician come to live in Madison. Unheard of. Mm-hmm. And I was born, apparently, without the ability to digest milk. And so I very nearly died. But you see, I didn't.
Yes, I see that you didn't. How long did this bias against women physicians generally last in Madison? When did the
Well, it gradually happen? Died out when Mrs. Mendenhall supervised the feeding of so many babies.
So especially, it was Mrs. Mendenhall who was
Mrs. Mendenhall,
partly, at least
oh, she was really
for
responsible for the mellowing of the attitude.
Now, your mother felt that way. Would that have been a feeling amongst men?
Well,
also?
She wasn't angry,
no,
but
I
just didn't believe in
she
it.
Didn't believe. What about men? Did they feel any different? Or
men didn't think that women belonged as doctors either. That they thought they should stay home and take care of the children.
So Mrs. Mendenhall sort of did both. Okay, now we come to another, probably the most famous doctor in Madison's name, Dr. Middleton.
Oh, Dr. Middleton. Dr. Middleton was a very good friend of mine, always. And when he was in the First World War, I told you, I knitted him a scarf and sent it to him. When I had an attack of what was appendicitis, he took me and rode with me in the ambulance to the Madison General Hospital.
Hmm. Was he a neighbor of yours?
No, we just knew him.
Oh, okay.
Well, and he was, he came out here at the request of Dr. Evans from Pennsylvania. I told you this before.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Van Velza came. The three were students together in the medical school at University of Pennsylvania. And the first one to come was Dr. Evans. And then Dr. Middleton and Dr. Van Velza followed.
Do you know anything about, was it just coincidence that it was the University of Pennsylvania? Was that a real famous medical school at the time? Or
I don't know whether it was just coincidental or not, but I think it certainly, they all came from there, those
and
three.
They pretty much formed the core of
yes.
the medical school for many years.
Yes, they did.
What
and was, Dr. Middleton was, he was very autocratic. And when he was dean of the medical school at the university, what he said went. There was no and, if, or but. He was also very anti-drinking. In fact, it was an obsession with him. This is funny. I was in the hospital with severe lacerations from an automobile accident that I'd been in 1932. Across the hall from me was a patient who was Bill Hoard.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Hoard was the son of former Governor Hoard and Hoard's dairyman.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and I had been friends over the years, and when he was Dr. Middleton's patient, and Dr. Middleton came to see him, he was there with indolent fever, Bill Hoard was, which didn't help any.
What kind of
indolent fever is a fever that cows get, and of course to have it in the Hoard's own herd was a touchy thing.
I see.
Anyway, Dr. Middleton went on his daily rounds and he stopped in to see Bill, his patient, and he said, "I smell liquor." Bill said, "You don't smell any liquor here. It's across the hall where Gertie is." Dr. Middleton said, "You're telling me a lie. I know perfectly well it's not Gertrude." And he found the liquor under Bill Hoard's bed. Well, he was really obsessed with it, with that idea.
That's interesting. And do you have any idea why that was such an obsession with him?
No, he was very rigid in his ideas.
Was he a specialist of any, or was he what you call a general practitioner?
No, I don't think he was a specialist.
Okay. So he was a surgeon?
No, he was dean of the medical school here, and internal medicine, and later dean.
Okay.
And then, of course, Middleton, the VA's name for him.
Yeah, right. He's, like I said, probably the most prominent medical name in medicine.
Yes, oh yes.
Medicine history. From Middleton, we go to another M, Monroe.
Well, Professor Monroe was in history. He's in the history department and a very, very, very splendid historian here. And Harriet Monroe was a friend of my sister's, who were older than I. And he left. I don't know where he went to.
Was Harriet Monroe from Madison originally?
Oh, yes, it was his daughter. I think he had more than one daughter, I'm not sure. But I was only a very little girl at the time.
Yeah, it was a ways back.
Yes, way back, no, early, probably around 19... five or something of that sort.
Next name is B.A. Morgan?
B.Q. Morgan.
B.Q. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Should be Q.
Yeah.
B.Q. Morgan was in the music school and also quite a colorful person. But I can't tell you any more than that.
here's a famous one. This is just like a
who?
Whodunit in UW history. Professor Otto.
Max Otto, his Rhoda Otto's a member of our Friday lunch group. Max Otto and my brother Philip were very close friends. All of Philip's friends were much older than he because he was very precocious, my brother. Max Otto was professor of philosophy and his famous course, Man and Nature, was what raised the roof in the state, especially with the regents, because he was accused of destroying the religion of students and giving them their belief in God and giving them nothing in place of it. Well, he weathered the storm. There was a move on foot to get rid of him, but he weathered the storm. And he was not got rid of. His wife, Rhoda, was very domineering and dominant person. And Max did what Rhoda told him to do. It wasn't always the best thing. Max was a gentle, very gentle and lovely person who was very interested in my sister Helen, as most of the men were.
I'm getting that idea.
But Rhoda didn't intend. When Rhoda Owen appeared on the scene, she had no use for my sister Helen. And she succeeded in breaking up any what might develop into a romantic association. But Max was really a very lovely person, but he was pulled around by the nose by his wife. Mm. And also he was very strongly instrumental in getting rid of Glenn Frank.
In what ways?
They didn't like Glenn Frank, wanted to get rid of him. But
so he was just sort of one of the anti-Frank
people. And I think all of the bad things or unhappy things, decisions that Max made were instigated by Rhoda. Mm. You take it, I wasn't very fond of her.
Right. Are you including the Frank Ulster in that category?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, obviously, from what you said, certainly Mary Frank was not a popular figure.
No, she was not. Well, she wasn't anything but a figure. Nobody really knew her or cared to know her.
Now, Max Otto also had something that he did that made him rather famous. When he lectured, he drew
Oh, yes, he was a splendid, he was a real artist. And I have a book that he gave me that I intend to give to his son and see that his son gets, which is illustrated by Max.
How did that come about? Was it just a hobby of his that developed?
Yes, it was just a talent he had, and he was, if he kept a diary, he would also illustrate it.
You don't happen to have any idea when he started doing that with his lectures?
No, I can't tell you when he did that.
It's one of the little things I'm trying to track down in the history, mm-hmm. and that's a tough one. What were his own personal religious beliefs? We know about what he taught about in his course.
Man and nature. He didn't believe in the traditional belief in God. And in other words, I always thought that ethics took the place of what we normally call religion, mm-hmm. with him. And Ellery Leonard used to say, religion signifies worship of something. Mm-hmm. It's not, religion means worship, not necessarily in one or another, but in some.
Love to see it. Okay, you can go now.
He believed in people, the goodness of people. He was a very good friend of Carl Bergholt, mm-hmm. who came here from Amherst.
Right.
But Rhoda didn't like Carl, and caused dissension between Max and Carl.
So she was a very dominant person.
She was dominant, and I didn't think she was kind. I thought she was definitely an unkind person.
Let me go back to something you just mentioned before when you were talking about the Regents. So one of the critiques of Otto about his course is that he didn't provide anything to replace the religion he was criticizing.
But he didn't provide a god.
He didn't provide a god.
He didn't provide a god.
And that was...
And you know that's a touchy subject.
Yeah.
Still is.
When he had his trouble with the Regents, were there any people rallying to his support?
Yes, people in the faculty here.
Any in particular that you can remember?
I couldn't tell you what, but I presume John Goss and that crowd probably.
It was a pretty prominent issue.
Oh, yes. It was very, very, very much in the news. Very much.
How did the Regents finally resolve it? Did they vote on it, actually?
I think they must have voted on it. Anyway, he won out. He wasn't fired.
And the students kept coming, didn't they?
Oh, yes. He was very, very popular.
From what I can gather, that may have been one of the two or three most popular courses.
Man and Nature.
Man and Nature. Everybody who was in the university at that point took it.
It seems.
Everyone I've interviewed, and everyone says it just influenced them tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Opened their eyes and made them start thinking.
Well, he and my brother Philip used to walk around Lake Mendota Sunday mornings. They'd start early and they'd be home by noon. And that's a 25-mile walk.
Jeez. That's a long way.
Well, Philip and Max were very close friends. My brother Philip.
Wow, that is a long walk. Okay, the next person we go to, Prokosh.
All I can tell you is that the name, Dr. Prokosh, and I think it was spelled capital Prokosch. And he was very, I don't know anything, it may have been, I don't know what his field is. Mm.
But that's a new one to me. I'm not familiar with
Dr. Prokosh. He was called Doctor.
Doctor. He was a doctor, not a professor.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we have Parkinson.
Oh, yes. The Parkinson family was a very important family in the days when the university had a vice president. One of the Parkinsons, either Ben or John, it was a large family, was vice president of the university in the early days around Van Hise time. The university then didn't have chancellors. but I presume the present chancellor grew out of what was then a vice president. In the Parkinson family, I think Mary Parkinson is still living, but she's married and widowed. They lived down on Langdon Street, and there was a number of Parkinson men, brothers. One of them was vice president at one time. I can't tell you which one for sure.
Oh, we can check that out. Ah, another very famous name coming up next, Selig Perlman.
Oh, Selig Perlman, yes. Professor of economics. And very significant professor of economics, along with Harold Groves. We had very, very splendid economics department, a very strong one, many years ago. I don't know what it is now.
Oh, that was its heyday, that's for sure.
Yes.
Perlman was one of the real
stars. Oh, yes, Selig Perlman. Lived right down here. And was, I think, an Orthodox Jew. You know, that's pretty rigorous.
Yeah. How was that accepted? Was there any problem with that?
Oh, it was perfectly accepted. In fact, this business of anti-Semitism, there wasn't any such thing in the 30s. At least if there was, I would certainly have had friends who would have heard about it. Mm-hmm. And I simply don't think there was.
Was Perlman married?
Oh, yes. His first wife died, and he married a second time, Eva Perlman, and then he married again. I think he had a brother, Mark Perlman, also.
I'm not sure of that. I don't know much about him at all, actually, aside from the name. And of course he taught. We have Paul S.
Reinsch. Paul S. Reinsch was minister to China. And that's what it was called in those days, minister to China. He was a very important person in Madison, a man of means, and whether he was actually on the faculty, I can't tell. Mm-hmm. But he was a very important person and was sent to China. I believe now we call them ambassadors.
Who sent him to China? The president? Who?
Probably.
And when was that about?
Oh, that would be about 1900 or between 1900 and 1910, something like that.
I think we mentioned that. What a trip to China must have been like
back
then. Yes,
R-E-I-N-S-C-H.
Yeah. Oh, here's another very famous name to all those egg people out there listening to this, Dean Russell.
Oh, Dean Russell. Yes, Eldon Russell and Margaret Russell. He had two children. And he was dean of the College of Agriculture. And the house is now lived in by, I don't know who lives there now.
That big one on campus?
Well, it's the one...
across from Slichter Hall.
Yes.
It's now a...
And there's a garden.
Experimental station.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And that was where the dean of the College of Agriculture was supposed to live, and he did live there. Eldon Russell, his son, may still be living, but I doubt it. And he had a daughter, Margaret.
What was Russell like as a person?
I can't tell you because I really didn't know him, but I think he was liked, and I think he was good.
Now we have the College of Ag, which is sort of out there in the sticks a little bit, campus.
Yes.
How did the Ag people relate to the LNS people? Was there a lot of interaction, or were people pretty much separate and distinct?
I think there was interaction. More than there is now. Because we had some very important people in the College of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And they weren't people who knew only agriculture either. They were people of wide cultural interests and education.
Do you know anything about the starting of WARF? Russell was
involved. Wisconsin Alumni Research
Associate Foundation.
Yes, Foundation. No, I know that it's Very significant.
Big money raiser, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you might know something about that. So there wasn't this case where the LNS people would look down on the Ag people?
I don't think so. I think the only ones that the law school looked down on the engineers, the students.
Well, let's talk about St. Pat's Day for a moment. Now, that's anybody who knows Wisconsin history has their own favorite St. Pat's Day story. Did you ever go to the parades or anything like that? The marches, the St. Patrick's Day marches that they had?
I didn't know we had them.
Well, those parades down State Street where people would pelt each other, the engineers would pelt the lawyers with eggs and the lawyers would...
Oh, they dump them in the water.
Well,
that was the rush. That was it on St. Patrick's Day? I didn't know that. But I don't think that the LNS people looked down on the College of Agriculture. Not in the heyday of the university. I don't think so. And they had no reason to. Yeah. But the law school students did look down on the students in the engineering school.
How did the school students in the engineering school view the students in the law school?
How did they what?
How did they view them?
They viewed them as snobs.
So they knew they were being snubbed.
They knew they were being snubbed. They knew it perfectly well.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
I don't know whether that still exists or not.
I don't know. I've never heard that spin on it before. I've heard that, maybe you can remember this, at graduation, didn't the law students toss their derbies in the air?
Something of the sort,
or something
yes.
Like that?
And the freshmen used to wear green caps.
Yeah. Which were
all the freshmen, boys,
yeah,
were designated to be freshmen by wearing a little green cap.
I actually saw one of those, and you're not supposed to see any, because at the end of your freshman year, remember, they had the big bonfire,
mm-hmm,
and part of the ritual.
Yes,
was
oh yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think they had to touch their top of their heads when they
something
passed a senior,
sort.
Beanie yes. on top of their head.
Now, Dean Trenor, dean of the College of Engineering, lived up on University Heights, and his son Stuart and I were friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have Dean Trenor on the list, so let's talk about him for a minute since we're on the end.
Dean Trenor, the house is on North Prospect Avenue, across the street from the Buell House, which was the first house to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Dean Trenor had one son, Stuart. His wife died, and Stuart was left without a mother when he was about 15 years old. Dean Trenor was a very elegant gentleman. So the law school didn't need to look down on him, I can tell you. And I think he had private means also. When his wife died, his sister, Donna Trenor, came and kept house for him. And Donna sort of brought Stuart up. Stuart himself became an engineer and mining engineer. And when he was married, he was called to Bolivia to inspect tin mines and lived there for 9 years.
Mm.
He used to write to me regularly and would send letters with the most beautiful stamps.
Mm.
Well, Donna wouldn't go with him. She said, if you're going to Bolivia, you go by yourself. I'll stay here with your father, which she did.
Mm.
So she stayed and lived with Dean Trenor while his son was 9 years in Bolivia.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, the College of Engineering before World War II was a lot different than what it is today.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any...
It was, I would say, more interested in what you and I would call culture.
Hmm.
And it was not interested, you know, in technology as much as it now is. You know, the College of Engineering now turns out all this stuff, computers and interested in stuff like that. And it's big business. Mm-hmm. Well, this wasn't the case. Of course, that part of that is the reason because of the times we live in. Mm-hmm. We live in a different era.
Yeah, from what I've heard, engineers before the war wouldn't have, they never had their PhDs, and they would get hired after they had successful, sometimes short, but successful careers in industry.
When was this?
This was before the war. This is from engineers that I've talked to. Mm-hmm. They had to have more hands-on experience.
I think there was a firm called Mead and Hunt here where you could get that experience.
What from your own perspective, why did the engineers look down? Why did they look down on the or the law, lawyers? Why did the law students look down?
Because they felt that the engineers didn't have any cultural background. That they were interested only in engineering, mm-hmm. but they knew nothing really in letters and science.
Okay, and then
which the law school did. I mean, you can't be a lawyer without knowing Latin.
That's true, yeah. That's
but I think you can be an engineer without being knowing Latin.
That whole distinction between those two particular schools
is very, yes, well, it was very significant. Yeah. I don't know whether it still is, but it's significant in my mind. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that I have any connection with you.
Sure sounds it was like it was significant in the minds of the lawyers and the engineers, too.
Certainly was.
Well, now we're going to go to a name that we've talked about before, and one of the skyrocket kings of all time, Benny Snow.
Oh, Benny Snow. He was a great friend of my father. In fact, he took charge of all the arrangements when my father died. He was professor of physics. And gave the famous lecture on snowflakes every single year. Lovely, lovely person.
One I didn't know too much about until we started talking, Dean Slichter.
Dean Slichter, oh, I can tell you a lot about him. My oldest childhood friend has died last August. She was married to one of the Slichter sons, Louis Slichter. And she lived on University Heights here. It was her father who built the first house. We built the second. Dean Slichter was professor of mathematics and for a long time dean of the graduate school also. He had four illustrious sons. I think all of them are dead now. Sumner went to Harvard as Harvard Business, professor in the Harvard Business School. Donald grew up and became president of the board of directors of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance. Louis, taught for a while at MIT and was seismologist and went from MIT to UCLA, where he ended his career, spent the rest of his teaching career. Alan was in business with Alice Chalmers. Now they're all dead. Mm-hmm. And Martha Slichter, my childhood friend, died last August.
And she was the...
And her, she had two daughters. Louis Slichter and Martha had two daughters. One who was a mental invalid always and later hospitalized. Mary Lou is living and married to an astrophysicist at Caltech. And wrote me a lovely letter. Oh, I got it probably about 6 weeks ago. Martha left me $1,000, which was lovely. And used to send me $100 every birthday and every Christmas.
Oh my.
for the time that I retired. Louis was a lovely person, Louis Slichter, and had a great deal of humor, which the rest of the Slichter sons didn't have.
Now, the father had humor too, didn't he?
Yes, but rather acid, rather sharp. And Mark Ingram wrote a book about him called The Golden Vector,
right,
which I have upstairs somewhere.
It has one of the nicest photographs, portrait photographs, I think I've ever seen of a person.
Well, I have down there a magazine, one of the Wisconsin alumni magazines, a whole story devoted to the Slichters.
Tell me a little bit about the dean and his personality.
Dean Slichter?
Yeah, you said he had sort of an accent.
I think he was pretty sharp. And I don't mean bright when I say sharp. I mean sharp-tongued. And not very much loved, but he was very good, I guess, very competent, both in his professor of mathematics and so on and so forth.
Yes, very influential.
Sometimes it's hard to assess people whom you've known very well.
Yeah, I could understand that.
And this is true because we knew the Slichters very well, the whole family.
From the Slichter, we go to someone else we've talked pretty much about him over the last few weeks, and that's Dean Celery, George Clark Celery.
Yes. When Dean Celery was dean, and my brother Philip was starting his teaching career at Leland Stanford University, Philip was home one summer, and Dean Celery called. I happened to answer the telephone. And he said, "Would you please tell your brother Philip the dean to call Dean Celery right away?" So I pinned a note on the pillow and said, "Dean Celery," and I spelled it C-E-L-E-R-Y, "wants you to call him." Well, Dean Celery asked my brother to take charge of the classics department that summer school because the person who was going to come dropped out at the last minute. So Philip, who was unbelievably young, around 20,
wow,
was in charge of the classics department.
Whoa.
That summer.
That's,
Dean Celery was a very competent person, not greatly loved, but I guess he was good.
Mm-hmm. Known for his firmness, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. Did he ever take any...
He wasn't loved like Max Otto.
Yeah, I must admit, you said you spelled the name with a C. did he ever take any ribbing because of the name being Celery?
I don't think so.
I think for years I thought his name was spelled C-E-L-E-R-Y.
Well, I was...
lucky they named the dorm after him.
You can gather that I was a young, very young child when I wrote that note, because Philip was 11 years older than I. He was the oldest of mother's five children, and I was the youngest.
Slaughter is the next name on the list.
Professor of Classics. And according to my friends now, he was good but not outstanding. He was not a great scholar, but he was competent. And he had a wife, Gertrude Slaughter, who took to writing in her late years. And I think she was probably more of a scholar than he was.
Hmm. Writing what?
Well, she wrote historical novels.
Oh.
One called Saladin, which she had published one or two. Macmillan Company had accepted them, and they refused the third, which made her very bitter. Mm. They said it wasn't good, it wasn't accurate.
Did this...
I happened to know about it because my brother was then with Macmillan Company in New York.
Did the first two sell pretty well?
Well, they did in Madison. I don't know whether anywhere else. They had a great tragedy. They lost both of their daughters. within a year of each other. From what, in those days, friends didn't know what it was. Probably some form of cancer. They're only children.
We have another person we've talked quite a bit about, but maybe you'd like to add a few more comments. That's Professor Frederick Jackson Turner.
Oh, yes. Professor Turner. Loveliest person. There's a typical example of a great man and a sweet man. Just as sweet as he could be. I told you I had my wedding breakfast in their house. And he got me my job at teaching at the Buckingham School in Cambridge.
Oh, he did?
Yes. At least it was his influence that decided them to take me. When I had the interview with the headmistress of the school, she said, "Well, you come very highly recommended by Professor Frederick Jackson Turner." And she said, "What makes you think that without any experience that you can handle the discipline?" I said, "I don't know that I can, but I certainly can give it a try." I had no trouble ever except with one child. And she was the daughter of Preserved Smith.
Preserved
Smith, professor at Harvard. Well, all of my pupils were
faculty,
Harvard faculty children. And she was, I did have trouble with her. And finally I said, "Well, I think you'd better go down the hall and talk to Miss Thompson." She refused to go. So I said, "Well, do you want me to tell Miss Thompson to come to see you because you won't go to see her?" Boy, she went. I never had any more trouble with her.
Huh.
Those were happy days.
Preserved Smith. Getting off the subject for just a sec, but how long did you teach at that school?
I taught there only a year and a half because then I was married. Married in the Christ Church where George Washington worshipped in Cambridge. Episcopal Church. Right within less than 5 minutes' walk of Harvard Yard. Do you know Cambridge at all?
A little bit. I've been there a few times.
Well, it's Garden Street. There's a big cemetery there. And at the end, one end of the cemetery is the Unitarian Church and the other end is the Episcopal Church. With the cemetery in between.
Cemetery separating the two of them. We have a name I'm not real familiar with here. I think it's Urdahl.
Oh, yes.
T.K.
Urdahl.
U-R-D-A-H-L.
U-R-D-A-H-L.
Tell me about
T.K. Urdahl, and his nickname was Teakettle Urdahl. They built at the house directly behind my house on what is now North Prospect Avenue, between the Ely House and ours. And he was professor of economics, and he had the great tragedy of his wife becoming insane and had to be taken out to Verona.
To the poorhouse?
Yeah, to the insane asylum.
You
see, there were the two.
The poorhouse and insane asylum were in the same building, but they were separate.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. That was the great shock of University Heights. And that was probably around 1912.
I don't really want to go into all the details, but what happened? How did she become insane?
Well, one knew in the first place something was wrong because every single day she would make two or three trips to the mailbox, which was right on the corner of Kendall Avenue and Prospect Avenue, right the mailbox, mailing letters out to non-existent people. And she got the idea that she was being persecuted. Well, finally, and I'll never forget it because it made a terrible impression on me and upset me very much when they came and took her away.
Now, again, this is for historical purposes. How did they come and take her away?
They had to put her in a straitjacket and haul her into a van.
There's literally two guys who came in white coats.
Yes.
Just like the stereotype. Yeah,
and it was a dreadful thing. The other dreadful thing that happened in University Heights was the death of my childhood friend, Ellen Stevens, Judge E. Ray Stevens' only daughter.
What happened there?
She came to my birthday party in 1911 and complained of a stomachache. So she didn't eat anything. She went home and was taken to the hospital. She had what was a ruptured appendix, peritonitis set in, and she died 10 days later. And Mrs. Stevens and the judge never really got over it. They had two sons. Myron is still living, and he's out at Attic Angel Tower with his wife.
Now, this woman who was taken away in the van in the straitjacket.
I think she died out there.
Oh, I was going to say, did she ever get released?
I think she never came back. No.
How long was she out there?
I don't know. You either went there if you were judged to be permanently insane, or you were temporarily insane, you went to Mendota.
So Mendota was sort of the
Mendota Hospital.
Hospital, yeah.
That was also, that also housed insane people.
So you would maybe get a little more treatment there? Was that the...
Well, I think that it was more temporary. Okay. Professor Leite's wife was there.
So when this other...
And she was released later on, but she was never really, she never looked the same again.
So when this other woman, Professor Erdahl's wife,
she died out there, I'm sure.
She was, when they went out there, that was pretty much like
that was a death sentence, really. It was terrible. Those two things on the Heights. You see, it was such a small neighborhood that one person's tragedy was another's. Yeah. That kind of neighborhood doesn't exist now. It may in some very small towns out other places in the United States, but not generally speaking.
Well, I think we're coming to an end.